Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Do you know how to best ease the suffering of the people you care about, or at the very least, how to avoid making them feel worse? A bout with breast cancer a few years ago forced my guest today to spend a great deal of time in doctor's offices and treatment center waiting rooms, and she passed some of those hours interviewing dozens of her fellow patients about their experiences with friends and family members who nearly always wanted to help but often said and did exactly the wrong things. Journalist and novelist Letty Cotton Pogrebin shares what she and her fellow patients learned about the things that are truly helpful in her new book, How to Be a Friend to a Friend Who's Sick. Letty, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. Good to be with you.
You know, I love this book because I think most of us imagine that we just sort of know intuitively how to do the right thing, and as it turns out, that may not be the case for a lot of us.
No, in fact, intuitively we do the wrong thing more often than not. We mouth cliches that we've heard other people say over the years without really asking ourselves, is that helpful? You know, is it helpful to say something like, I'm sure you'll be okay, or this will pass, or God only gives you as much as you can handle? Not really.
Yeah.
Not only in my own experience, as you said, as a breast cancer patient, watching and listening to my own friends, but more importantly, in my interviews with 80 people in the waiting room and in other aspects of life, people said those kinds of lines were simply not helpful. So I try in the book to arouse consciousness and ask people to adopt a new honesty ethos, which is a new kind of etiquette where you simply say really what you're thinking, which is more often than not, gee, I feel terrible that you're sick. Or, you know, please tell me how I can help. I really mean it. And you have to say, I really mean it. Because if you just say, how can I help, no one's going to answer you.
Yeah.
Because it's a cliche. You have to get out of the cliche mode and into the honesty mode.
Now, a question like, how are you, strikes us as innocent enough, but you found it maddening when people would put a sort of grave weight to that question when they would talk to you when you were sick.
Yeah, it's like the Irish wake shake. You know? For most people, I mean, we say, how are you every day, many times a day to all kinds of people. That's the problem with it, because when you say, how are you to a sick person, it's a whole different thing requiring a different level of response. As a sick person, I had to think, how much do I really want to tell them? I had to think, do they really care? I had to think, will this be boring? Do they have the time to listen? Should I tell them exactly what's happening, or how should I cut it, you know? How are you? It's usually asked, not as, how you doing, but how are you? Dripping with doom and tragedy. So that's one of the lines, Chris, that I found really problematic, surprisingly so, but factually so.
Yeah, and then, you know, I think it's so interesting, the burden of, and you just alluded to this, of having to answer and provide your story all over again when you might not be feeling good, you might be exhausted, you might just not feel like talking about your illness at this moment.
Yeah, that was something I discovered really early on. When I first sent out my informational email to my closest friends, and I chose very carefully 12 close friends whom I thought would be supportive and just the right kind of people to travel in the land of the sick with, you know, who would be there for me in a way I needed. But at the bottom of my email, I said, please don't tell anybody. And it wasn't because I think cancer is the C word like it was in my mother's time in the 50s when she died, and nobody knew she was even sick because she wouldn't tell anyone. It wasn't for that reason. It was because I really didn't want to have to answer questions and phone calls and so on from all kinds of people in outer circles of my friendship world. Sure enough, 3 days after I sent out my email, I get a phone call or an email, I forgot what, from somebody who wasn't in that first circle. And then more emails, phone calls, a get well card, you know, from people who were colleagues, ex-colleagues, friends of my husband's clients, you know. It got to be absurd. My news of my diagnosis metastasized. And for me, that was the most difficult part of negotiating friendship and illness was how many times I had to start from scratch. I had to go back to the part I wanted least to deal with, and that was, you know, the first stage, the diagnosis. But each new person who called asked the same questions, and to be polite, you answer.
Yeah. Yeah, and I guess there's the question of, am I answering this because it's, I mean, entertaining is the wrong word, but is someone simply curious, or do they actually care about me?
Yeah, that's true. And that's one of the reasons why, as you will remember, I really plead for an absolute honesty policy where, at the very beginning, if you're just now getting a diagnosis, put out the word, I want you to be totally candid with me. I want to be able to be totally candid with you. Friend to friend, sick person to well person, or well person to sick person. I want to be able to say, and I wish I had done that, from the get-go, don't drop in. I really don't want unannounced visits. That's not my style. I don't want you to come when I might be tired or when I might look, you know, like death warmed over, and I really want people to call first. And frankly, I don't really want visits anyway.
Yeah.
Because I didn't. When in my interviews, I was astonished at how many people said they really didn't want to be visited when they were sick. You know, long term, okay. But when you're first sick, you really don't necessarily want to interact. As you said, there's almost a compulsion to entertain. You feel, you know, the person took the trouble to come and they just brought me a get well gift. I have to be nice. I have to make conversation. I have to take away their fears.
Mm-hmm.
We, as friends, bring our fears with us when we visit a sick person because we all feel suddenly vulnerable. You know, we're brushing close to someone else's mortality. A lot of people treat you as if it's catching, even if it's nothing remotely catching.
And I guess, you know, it's funny about the visiting thing because people always think, oh, well, sure, you want visitors. You just don't want to put me out. And it's funny that we can't just listen to a person who's sick who says, please don't drop by the hospital. Please don't come by my house.
Right.
Why do you think we just assume that we know better than the person who's telling us exactly what they want?
Because we've been taught that that's the right thing to do, or because our religious tradition underlines that obligation. You're supposed to visit the sick.
Mm-hmm.
I gave a talk the other night before a Jewish group, and in Judaism there is, in fact, a commandment to visit the sick. And there is the notion that when you visit, you remove 1/60th of the person's suffering. So that's a very strong impulse, a rationale to visit the sick. But there's another commandment that you should not do unto others what you do not want done unto you. So I raised this contradiction, you know, and there was a rabbi there, and he said, you know, even as a rabbi, he has to think about that balance, because if you visit, as I, in fact, interviewed one person who told me their pastor came to visit them and stayed for 2.5 hours, he felt he was being helpful and solicitous, but he didn't pick up on the body language. You know, we give each other signals. What we have to do is learn to read them. The signal of a drooping eyelid might be one, you know, one reason to leave. Most people, in fact, stay way too long.
Yeah.
You know, they either have kidded themselves that their presence is in itself healing, which is a little arrogant, but some of us sort of feel, you know, I'm going to jolly them up, I'll make them feel good, and blah, blah, blah. That doesn't always work. And others of us feel, you know, I took a 40-minute drive to get here. I'm going to stay 40 minutes to amortize it. And I found, after interviewing all these people, that the most people wanted you to stay is 20 minutes. And if you're in pain, they really don't want you to stay more than 5 or 10 minutes. We must stay tuned in. We have to, again, have the freedom to ask each other, you know, is this comfortable? Are you in pain? Would it be better if I came back another time? You seem to be tired. I'm just going to run and have a cup of coffee and maybe come back later. This isn't a good time. That kind of sensitivity somehow or other eludes us. I, as you may remember, in the book I suggest that the friend should feel able to ask the patient the following. Tell me what's helpful and what's not. Tell me when you want to be alone and when you want company. And tell me what to bring and when to leave.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine if we could say that and then know that we don't have to guess. We don't have to worry about awkwardness or making a mistake or, you know, imposing on our friend's time or straining a sick person. We know they will tell us what's helpful and what's not. They'll tell us when they want to be alone and when they want company. And they'll tell us what to bring and when to leave. The what to bring part, you know, if you know that your friend's going to bring you a present, you don't want another bouquet of flowers. Your hospital room is full of flowers, half of them dying.
Mm-hmm.
The friend should be able to think twice. What is the condition of my friend? What's her personality type? What is, lies ahead for her? And maybe bring her a bed jacket because she's a person who likes to feel elegant and put together, and she's going to be in bed for a couple of weeks. Or maybe bring him a fresh pair of pajamas. Do something that's really relevant to the person's status and condition.
Letty Cotton Pogrebin is my guest. She's the author of a new book called How to Be a Friend to a Friend Who's Sick. We'll come back to our conversation in a moment. And if you've got something to ask or something to add, we'd love to hear from you at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We'll speak more with Letty in a few minutes. Right now, we want to give you an update on the spring fundraising campaign. $232,000 left to raise. We need 40 contributions to stay up to date in this hour of Think. We have 5 so far. You can make your contribution right now by calling 1-888-694-6931 or going online to kera.org. Jeff Whittington is now in studio. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. I want to thank Stephen Byrne and Rockwall and Evelyn Luciani and Dallas for making a contribution this hour. Today is the 12th day of this membership campaign. We've just about reached that point where we can really start to move closely toward the $650,000 goal. So to encourage you right now, we invite you to enter another drawing after the end of All Things Considered tonight at 6:30 this evening. One lucky person who makes a contribution today will win the choice of an iPad or a Microsoft Surface tablet computer. All week you've been meaning to become a new member or renew your membership or even make an additional gift. Well, this is the opportunity right now. And we also have copies of Letty's book available when you make a contribution today.
That's right. It's available at the $10 a month level or above. And you can do that by going online to kera.org or calling 1-888-694-6931. I really liked this book, Jeff. And it's something that I think you can read now, even if you don't have someone who is sick or going through a period of grief and mourning, but pick it up later. You know, you'd be surprised as we all, you know, get older. We have friends who are dealing with these situations. This is such a practical, thoughtful guide and makes so much sense. And I would imagine people who have been sick would have their own things to add to it. But it's really, really fascinating.
Just call 888-694-6931 and make a $120 contribution. That's just $10 a month if you become a sustaining member of the station, which is what a lot of people are choosing to do. Or you can go online to kera.org and you can pick it up there with our thanks. It's just a thank you gift, thanking you for doing your part, helping keep a place where these kinds of conversations can happen every day. That's what KERA is all about. That's why it's worth your support.
Your contribution keeps public radio strong in North Texas. What a special thing that is to be part of the team that makes KERA possible. If you love this station, the only way to really, truly be part of the station is to become a financially supporting member at kera.org or at 1-888-694-6931. Back in 2 minutes with Letty Cotton Pogrebin.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering summer courses for adults in literature and languages, cultural history, and arts and design at the Dallas, Plano, and Taos, New Mexico campuses. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is novelist and journalist Letty Cotton Pogrebin. Her new book is called How to Be a Friend to a Friend Who's Sick. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. It seems another thing that's really important to remember, Letty, is that people who find themselves ill, perhaps for the first time, perhaps for the, you know, a time in a series, are often embarrassed to need help when they've been accustomed to taking care of themselves. Can you talk about ways to alleviate that and be able to offer help that is useful?
Yeah, I mean, it goes even beyond being reluctant to ask for help. There are people who keep their sicknesses a secret.
Mm-hmm.
I encountered that an amazing number of times, especially in men. I think we have to recognize that there's a gender difference in both the behavior of the sick people and the friends that I interviewed. Men were much more likely than women to have not confided in anyone but their wives or partner, precisely because they don't want help. They're not accustomed to taking help. They see illness as weakness and weakness as emasculating. And it's very hard to be in a position where suddenly you feel powerless when prior to that you felt autonomous and able and confident and comfortable and all of that. It's a little more effortless for women because we confide our weaknesses in each other all the time.
Mm-hmm.
That's what women friends do. We gain strength and succor from one another. So we don't need to go into a whole new behavioral mode, whereas for men very often, you know, it's a terrible admission, especially if it's, say, prostate cancer or testicular cancer, something that really affects the masculine essence of a person. And men told me that, one man said to me, if you're going to get sick, you better have women friends, because you don't get anything from your men friends. What they'll do is, if you're in extremis, like you have you're in a motorcycle accident, they'll show up at the hospital, you know, and they'll maybe move your bed for you or hook up your TV for you. But in terms of long-term sort of caring, that's not going to be easy to get from most men. It's not in their MO. You know, I should say that this book is not just about people who are sick in body, but those who are sick at heart.
Yeah.
People who are depressed, people in mourning, and friends who have to relate to, say, the parent of a child who is sick or dying or who has passed away. I have a chapter even on somebody who is sick because of money worries. They lost all their money with Madoff, all their money, everything. They went from being completely self-sufficient to being in poverty, and that made them sick. And, you know, I talk about people who have had surgery and people who have chronic illnesses and people who are dealing with friends who have Alzheimer's. I don't know if you've ever had that experience, but suddenly with an Alzheimer's patient, you're in the room with somebody who looks as if they're just fine and they don't know who you are.
Mm.
You were their roommate in college or you were their fraternity brother and they have no memory of it. So what's left to call a friendship? That's a very big question, and many people have to grapple with it because Alzheimer's is, you know, it's rife all over this country.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to the phone now. We have Mark on the line in Denton. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Chris, and thank you, you and your author, for a wonderful program. Ironically, it's very germane to my experience at the moment, my wife and I. And my question was, what would the author have comments about spousal or partner dynamics during times of illness and the interactions and the wishes and desires and the kinds of negotiations and just the complexities of how couples deal with these kinds of moments? And I'll take my answer off air. Thank you.
Oh, wait, Matt, Mark, before you go off air, which of you is going through the illness?
My wife is sick. She has ovarian cancer, and this is about 14 months into it, and it's been you know, a real life-changing event. And ironically, 2 years ago or 3 years ago, we started watching Laura Linney in The Big C. Hmm. And now this season, we're watching it from very different perspectives.
Yeah.
We laugh and chuckle, and there's lots of good humor that keeps us going.
Yeah. Well, Mark, you more or less answered the question by asking it. The complexities are as varied as the couples are and as each party is individually. For me, and I don't mean to be simplistic or do a one-liner, but the very basic truth of the situation is what the patient wants. That's it. The patient calls the game, calls the shots, because that, though it's hard to live with someone who's very sick, especially when you have a prognosis that may not be so heartening, the sick person is the person who is living with it internally and externally, is feeling it, and is also in the midst of the dynamics that you mentioned. So it seems to me that as hard as it may be, if she wants to talk her head off about her symptoms, you got to listen. If she wants to be alone and you have to respect it, if she wants to sit with you in the silence, that's what you give. I think it's entirely up to us to adapt to our sick spouse or partner.
There are ways, though, that I think friends can also help the caregiving partner. Can you talk about some things that we can do to relieve someone who is sort of the 24/7 caregiver?
Yeah, that's a very big issue. And I interviewed people who had figured out how to do it, where they formed friendship circles or networks that, for example, a portion who's going to take the patient to chemo, they spread it out so that the caregiver doesn't have to be the only one, that a friend takes every other Tuesday and another friend takes every other Thursday and so on. Also, rather than show up with a casserole, and then find that there are four other macaroni and cheese casseroles on the counter that have been delivered by friends, why not organize a food delivery friendship circle where you, again, parcel out who's going to bring dinner and what it's going to be and planning menus together. But then those friends working in concert really provide a service that's needed. Somebody else figured out that it might be a relief to have a bunch of friends pick up the patient's children after school, so that was one thing that she could cross off her to-do list. And they organized that one. So these kind of collective caring circles are marvelous. I write about one of them where a French-American lawyer had a group of 15 friends who took turns taking her to chemo and then taking her to lunch if she was up to it or taking her home so she could nap. And at the end of her series of chemo, she chose to give a lunch to honor the friends who had been with her through this ordeal.
Wow.
And she went around the room to 15 people and said to each one personally the most memorable thing that she sort of had in her head and her heart about the time that person took her.
Mm-hmm.
And my daughter happened to be one of those 15, and she said, "Mom, when she got to me, I was so worried that she wouldn't have an anecdote. I didn't think I was good enough. I didn't think I came through in a big way."
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the French-American lawyer had a wonderful anecdote about my daughter's particular interaction with her on one of her days. And at the end, she gave, and the reason I mentioned the French-American part, she gave everyone a little needlepoint, framed needlepoint, with the word merci, thank you in French, that she had needlepointed on it with each friend's name on the back.
Wow.
So it was a matter of giving to her and then her giving back this enormous gift of gratitude that made everybody feel that they were a community, they had come through for another human being, and here was sort of something to take away in their hands as a reminder that their friend had gotten through it with their help.
And we all need to remember that maybe our awesome unsolicited advice is not a gift. that what our friends need from us is friendship and not medical advice.
Yeah, we've got doctors for medical advice. But part of the problem of not feeling that you can do anything, of feeling powerless, is that you feel you have to give something to your sick friends. So you give advice, or you get very self-referential. I had that. You know, I also had whooping cough, you know, or when I had pneumonia, I took such and such. Why don't you go to this acupuncturist? All that kind of advice, which simply clutters the mind. The sick person is full of things they have to remember that their doctors told them, medicines they have to take, appointments they have to get to. They don't need you prescribing. They need you for what they need you for. And advice is not it.
We have an email here from Jennifer in Athens, Texas, who says, my son was stillborn. Something occurred to me. One thing I would add for strangers as well as friends to not press or mention is religion or God. Many times I was told this was God's plan or that my son was now in his hands and I could move on.
Right. That is so maddening. Everybody said that. Everybody said, I don't like the God lines. They sound empty. They're hollow. You know, my religion is my business. I'll deal with my church or synagogue or mosque or pastor or rabbi or whatever. I don't really want my friends telling me what God wants.
Well, it can read like someone saying you don't really need to grieve and you're sort of bothering everyone with your grief if you don't just accept that this is the reason it happened.
Right. Another thing, that's absolutely right. Another thing that bereaved parents told me, and I have a chapter where I interview parents who lost a child to illness, to accident, or to suicide. Because what do you say to somebody like that? I mean, it's enough to make you mute.
Yeah.
And they all said, I don't want people to avoid mentioning my child. And people just don't mention my child. They think that if they mention my child, somehow or other, I'm going to be less bereft. Somehow or other, I'm sorry, that's a call waiting noise. We can ignore it.
That's all right. You know what? I want to talk more about this. We need to take a break right now, so hang on to that, and we'll talk about this because I think it's really important to get to the grain of this. So hold just a second. My guest is Letty Cotton Pogrebin. She's a journalist and novelist. She's also author of a new book called How to Be a Friend to a Friend Who's Sick. If you'd like to be part of this conversation, we have lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. In the meantime, while we are taking this break, I want to remind you we have $232,000 left to raise in this fundraising drive. One way that you can help us out is to make a gift of $10 a month or more and receive as your thank you gift a copy of Letty's book, How to Be a Friend to a Friend Who's Sick. You can do that by going online to kera.org or by calling 1-888-694-6931. 11 contributions so far this hour. We need 40 in this hour of Think, so we're getting a bit behind here. But as we take this, you know, 4 or 5 minute break, this is the perfect time to do it. Hi, Jeff Whittington.
Hey, Chris. This is a great time for you to make your contribution. Call 888-694-6931 or click and contribute online at kera.org. As Chris mentioned, we do have copies of How to Be a Friend to a Friend Who's Sick by Letty Cotton Pogrebin available today when you join at the $120 membership level. You can also spread that out as a sustaining member, $10 a month contribution. It's very easy for you to set up. And honestly, it's what a lot of people are doing. That level is about the average gift of folks who've decided to support the station. Hey, look, it's the 12th day of the membership drive. We've made great progress. We were hoping to do this drive in a shorter period of time, but 12 days for us to raise the $650,000 necessary to keep the station running efficiently and appropriately and serving you the way you want to be served, 12 days isn't too bad, and we can still get your call in today at 888-694-6931. Your contribution is always welcome online as well at kera.org.
It is such a privilege to be able to bring you a show like Think because you are sort of with us day to day. We talk about everything under the sun, how to care for a sick friend. In the next hour, we're going to be talking about the expansion of the CIA's capabilities since 9/11 and the way that has changed the culture of the CIA and the Pentagon. We talk about every possible topic, and you are with us. We're able to do this because of your support. Frankly speaking, it's expensive to put a show on the air that is generated locally. There's a little staff involved. There are, you know, costs involved with production. Your contributions make this possible. We're really proud that KERA is able to bring this to you. Many of you listen to the show daily in the podcast. You download it and listen to it it on your own time. If you happen to have time shifted this broadcast, we can tell you that the phone number will still work, 1-888-694-6931. And the website, of course, is always able to take your contributions. Let us know that you appreciate an always available podcast that you may have even shared with your friends.
Yeah, we know that thousands of you listen to the podcast, or at least you download it every month. And we would love to be able to help offset some of the costs related to producing it. We've also, got a more and more robust digital presence coming to you from KERA. KERA.org has recently been redesigned. KERANews.org is available as well. Of course, ArtandSeek.org is available. All of these are digital properties that come from North Texas Public Broadcasting. When you make your contribution, you help make sure that all of these digital streams, these places where you can go to get your public radio content, your KERA content, are there and are there for you every single day. So it does come with a cost to provide this kind of service. We're not just doing the radio broadcast anymore. We're trying to make sure that you have the ability to access what we're doing here on your behalf and for you everywhere, all the time, and it comes with a cost. So help offset it. Make a contribution at 888-694-6931 or click and contribute at kera.org.
It really doesn't take much of your time. It doesn't even take much out of your budget if you become a sustaining member, where we take the money out a little bit of time at a time each month. We have 12 contributions so far this hour. To make our goals for the first hour of Think, we are looking for 40. So if you have not yet joined the station, if you have not yet renewed your membership, we would ask that you take action now at kera.org or 1-888-694-6931. And everybody who signs up today as a member is automatically enrolled in the drawing, right, Jeff?
Yeah, we're going to have another drawing this evening. For one lucky person will win the choice of an iPad or a Microsoft Surface tablet computer. If you've already contributed, you're already in the drawing. But if you haven't, call 888-694-6931. Or give online at kera.org.
A nice little possible bonus, but of course the real reason that you make a contribution is to support radio that means something to you and to your community and really contributes to your life. We would really appreciate hearing from you now online at kera.org or over the phone at 1-888-694-6931. Back in 2 minutes with Letty Cotton-Pogrebin.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering summer courses for adults in literature and languages, cultural history, and arts and design at the Dallas, Plano, and Taos, New Mexico campuses. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We are sitting this hour with Letty Cotton-Pogrebin, who has written a book called How to Be a Friend to a Friend Who's Sick. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. And before we broke, Letty, you were talking about the importance of, we shouldn't assume that we ought not to mention the name of a loved one, and in particular a child who has died.
Yeah, I think it's true. A loved one of any age. Very often we feel if we mention the loved one, that we'll make the person cry. Well, maybe we will, but the person wants more than anything else to believe that their child is remembered. So if you don't mention that child, because you're basically protecting your own yourself from the discomfort of seeing somebody else's emotion,
yeah,
then you're kind of telling you're suggesting that you think you have the power to keep that person from grieving. You know, if I don't mention him, then she won't feel bad. That's simply not true. The reverse is true. What people told me over and over again was they want to hear a memory from you. They want you to say, I just will always remember how he puffed on that tuba in the school band, or I remember how she was so kind to my child, or something that says, you know, your loved one registered in my life in a positive way. That's the gift that you want. The amazing thing is how often people say the most hurtful things, like, I hope you've reached closure. You know, it's been 6 months. I hope you've reached closure. Kind of rushing the person through the grieving process, or saying, you know, come on out, I'll buy you a drink, as if you can drown such a sorrow in alcohol. The chapter I wrote on this book was informed, I think, as I said, by parents who'd been through it, and they were absolutely unanimous in saying they wanted to talk about their child, they wanted to hear a memory about their child, and they didn't want anyone telling them when to stop grieving.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Vivia in Fort Worth. Hi, Vivia.
Hi. I'm enjoying your show.
Thank you.
I wanted to say how happy I am that this has been written. I was very ill and in the hospital for a very long time, and I was astonished at how exhausting all the calls and visits were. And part of that, I finally realized, was everyone was wanting reassurance from me.
Hmm. Yeah.
Reassurance that I was going to get well, reassurance that I knew how much they cared. And that's just, it was amazingly draining. And I thought, you know, Miss Manners needs to do a column on this.
Yeah, I mean, because that's the old etiquette, is that you come through for somebody and then you feel good about yourself. You know, you send a plant and then you feel good about yourself that you've been a good friend. You come and sit in the sick room and you feel, I put in my time, you know, I took time out of my own day. But it's not about, you know, us. It's about the sick person and what they need. And we have to remember that we're not the only ones asking that how are you that drives sick people crazy. And we're not the only ones who are coming sitting by the bedside and, you know, maybe getting a little too close with having had a garlic pizza. You know, you need to think at a deeper level of consciousness than the average friendship demands. Mm. When you're friends with somebody, it's relaxed, you know, it's instinctive, you have your patterns and rhythms, but when sickness is a third party in the room, you have to stop and think about everything. Everything you say and everything you do, and you have to ask for guidance and say, I mean it. Don't just say, when should I visit? Say, you know, I really don't want to come unless you're up for it. Mm-hmm. I'm ready to come any time, but I need you to tell me the truth. Do you want me now? That kind of thing. Stop and make it a real conversation. Don't just mouth off about the same old bromides that we've been hearing for 100 years.
I hope you don't mind me mentioning this, because it is in the book. You're in your early 70s, and I wonder if we get better at this as we get older, because, you know, when you have a friend who's grieving or who's very ill in their, say, their 40s, it's almost a novel event, whereas once everyone has aged more, it's something that more people have personal experience with.
Yeah, I wish I could say that's true, but it doesn't seem to be true at all. You're right about the fact that people are a little more stunned and blindsided when they get sick in their 30s or 40s or have to deal with friends who are. That's unexpected, and it violates the sort of lifespan rules that we all grew up with. But I heard about people in their 60s, 70s, and 80s who told me astonishing things that friends of theirs in their age group had said to them, that showed that they hadn't learned a thing, you know, not a thing. Somebody said, gave news of their diagnosis, and a friend immediately said, is it terminal? You know, somebody else told me, they were told, are you sure it's not in your head? I mean, these are people who should know better.
Mm-hmm.
A woman who had a mastectomy said, more than one person had said to her, well, at least you're married.
Oh.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
And the line that a lot of us hate, I in particular, is, you look great. You know, we don't say to our friends every day when we see them, you look great.
Right.
They say it when they're sick. And the sick person knows perfectly well.
That you're lying, right.
Yeah, that you're lying.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then there was somebody who said to a grieving widow, I know just how you feel because my dog died last year. I mean, the equation of a person and a dog, I heard more than once.
Yeah.
You would think, how can anybody let those words out of their mouths? But for them, it's real. They really suffered at the loss of their dog, and they're thinking about them. They're thinking about how being with you makes them feel. It reminds them of their sorrow with their dog, and they don't necessarily think of how it sounds to you.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Sarah on the line in Wichita Falls. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. I love the show. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm 35 years old. I have rheumatoid arthritis. I was diagnosed 5 years ago after the birth of my first son. And I just wanted to call and comment on the frustration that someone, and I'm sure this is with a number of chronic illnesses that, you know, I'm going to have rheumatoid arthritis forever, and there's a large amount of pain. You know, the breakdown in communication with people that I have relationships with is really difficult because, you know, it's an invisible disease. I look normal, but I have a lot of pain. And, you know, I might be smiling, but that doesn't mean that I'm not in pain. If I frowned whenever I was hurting, I'd be frowning my entire life. Mm-hmm. So it's tough because when you have a chronic illness like this, it feels like especially when it's invisible, that people forget that you kind of, you know, weren't too lucky in the cards you were dealt necessarily considering your health. And then, you know, I mean, you don't want people to pity you. But at the same time, like, you know, it is nice to have people recognize, you know, or say how are you feeling. And before, when y'all were talking just before but you don't look sick, or, you know, but you're so young.
Yeah, you look great. It's a very delicate balancing act because you don't want overly solicitous friends, but you want them to have a double consciousness. We all want to be normalized, those of us who've been sick. And in your case, with a chronic illness, and I heard this over and over again, people had ALS, people had MS and diabetes, and, you know, the invisible illnesses that are chronic and are never going away, they violate our culture's norm, which is you get sick, you get treated, you get well. And when that doesn't happen, like when you don't, quote, get better, people really don't know how to handle it because mm-hmm. it's long term, and it's asking them to adjust to something that's not going to change or maybe even going to get worse. Again, it requires more consciousness than most friendships allow for, than most friendships are tuned into. And if I were you, I would just level with my friends. I would, whenever somebody disappoints you, say, you know, I know you mean the best, but frankly, you're assuming that I'm pain-free, and right now I'm not. I'm not comfortable, you know, sitting for long periods of time on a bleacher or whatever it is that is expected of you in this friendship, that the person has forgotten that you're not able to do everything they are. Raising somebody else's consciousness is a gift because then they don't have to feel bad about themselves for how they miscalculated.
Yeah, and I guess in good ways and sometimes in bad ways, friendships are forever changed by this sort of thing.
Totally. They are totally changed, which is why a lot of people just turn tail and disappear because they can't handle that. It asks something of them that they didn't contract for in a friendship. Now, I have to say something about Alzheimer's because that is the one situation where people very often have to, for their own sake, people who are the friend who's well, has to abandon the friendship because it becomes too enervating, too depressing, and really without content because the other person doesn't know who you are, and you have no memories to share and you have no conversation that makes any sense. But the important thing in that situation is do not abandon the caregiver.
Mm-hmm.
Don't abandon the spouse who already has lost their loved one, though the person sitting right there in the room, and should not have to lose their friends as well. I would encourage people to come through in those situations, even if you can't maintain a friendship because there's no there, to take the caregiver out for dinner, to include the caregiver and you're going to the movies, to provide, if they can't afford it themselves, provide a paid caregiving service to give them some relief. A bunch of friends can get together and pay for one day a week to relieve that caregiver so it's not 24/7 on their shoulders.
The new book by journalist and novelist Letty Cotton Pogrebin is called How to Be a Friend to a Friend Who's Sick. Letty, thank you so much for joining us this hour. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you, Chris.
Thanks to all of you who are listening this afternoon. We greatly appreciate you being part of the Think audience. We especially appreciate those of you who are supporting members of KERA. If you've never done this before, it takes just a couple of minutes of your time to establish a membership. Many people like to do the sustaining memberships, which is just a monthly draw out of your checking account or your debit account or your credit account. And you can do this by going online to kera.org, or you can call 1-888-694-6931. And Jeff Whittington, we do have copies of Letty Cotton Pogrebin's book available as a thank you today.
We do, and you join the station at a $120 level or $10 a month as a sustaining member. You can choose to receive your very own copy of Letty's book, How to Be a Friend to a Friend Who's Sick. Just check it out online at kera.org or call 888-694-6931. Thanks to Colleen Saunders in Waxahachie and Rosa Salazar in Grand Prairie and Ray Bronner in Dallas. Thank you so much for joining the station here in the last few minutes.
Thank you so much, Bhagya Armgam in Dallas. Thank you, Andrea Calloway in Dallas and Sharon Peters in Arlington. Really appreciate that.
888-694-6931. Online at kera.org. Chris, we've heard from 21 listeners this hour, looking for about 19 more in the next couple of minutes to wrap up this hour successfully. We've got about $231,000 left to raise in this membership campaign. Yesterday, we started with nearly $300,000 left to raise, so we're making great progress, and we know that once we get below that $200,000 mark, things will start to happen faster and faster, because many of you do, you know, we know, because we do this three times a year. Many of you do wait until we get much closer to make your call. But if you'll make your call right now or your online contribution right now, it would really help us get there that much faster.
1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number to support your belief in quality journalism, in really well thought out programming, in intelligent programming. You can also make your contribution online at kera.org. Lots of people don't take a thank you gift, but if that would help you sort of get over the hump and think, all right, I'll do this, please take a thank you gift. That's why we put them there. There's no discouragement. They're right there, and you can check them all out online at kera.org. So if you already have a copy of Letty's book or you want to run out and buy it today, then you could choose another thank you gift from our extensive list, including, you know, we have Think mugs, we have, you know, aprons, I don't know what we have. We have all kinds of good stuff.
888-694-6931 or online at kera.org. Again, the phone number, 888-694-6931. Or go to the website, kera.org, and click on the support banner. It's really easy for you to make your contribution. Just takes about 90 seconds, and you'll be well on your way to helping KERA stay strong and healthy financially for the next year.
A KERA membership is a really easy decision to make, I think, because you've been sampling the product for all this time. You know that it is, not only is it not going to get any worse if you spend money, you know, all that extra cash might allow us to give you even more coverage. You know, many of you have noticed and thanked us for expanding the amount of local and regional news coverage we're providing. We are so happy to, thanks to your generosity, be able to respond to those requests and give you what you've asked for. Our online presence is growing. There's all kinds of new features and functions on the website at kera.org. And of course, for a long time on kera.org, there has been that support button, which is what we're asking you to go and click on right this very moment.
Well, and Chris, you said it when you said you've been sampling for a while. Well, the chip bowl at the grocery store aisle is getting low.
Would you stand there and eat while there's a line behind
right,
you?
Right. And it's time to help fill that chip bowl up with a fresh bag. And somebody's got to buy the bag. And, you know, it's like buying a bag of chips. It's really not a big deal. You've come to the party, and all you had to do is pick up one bottle of wine or one six-pack of beer or, you know, maybe some soft drinks or make some special tea or bring coffee or bring pastries. Everybody else brought
just
stuff.
Just getting hungry.
Everybody else brought stuff, but you just have to pick up that one thing. That's what we're asking you to do. Make that one contribution and you'll be doing your part.
You know, for a long time, and I'm not quite sure why we did this, we used to talk all the time about how much people were spending at Starbucks and saying, if you would just spend that money with KERA, well, here's the reality. You don't have to cut anything out. Most of us don't have to cut anything out to become a member of the station because you can decide the level at which you give. So you can do a one-time gift. I mean, you know, when we say any amount, we mean any amount. You can do a one-time gift or you can do a sustainable, sustaining membership. They start at $5 a month, which is affordable mm-hmm. for just about everybody listening, I would venture to guess. KERA.org is the place to set that up, or you can call in right now to 1-888-694-6931. We really appreciate your engagement with the station. $231,000 left to raise, and then the drive is done.